Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
While the situation is almost under control, there is a small pocket of resistance, but we didn't call them resistance. We tried to overcome them, that's all. But the city is under the siege and the control of the rebels of the Libyan free people.
That was a member of the Libyan National Transitional Council, or NTC, talking in a video from the UK newspaper The Telegraph. We've been following, of course, the situation in Libya as part of our coverage of the so-called Arab Spring, and today, kind of wall-to-wall earlier in the morning, because it looks like the rebels are gaining control of Tripoli, and the White House says it has passed a tipping point. Reports are that the Libyan prime minister has fled the country, and rebel forces have taken over the television station. You were hearing this in the NPR newscast at the top of the hour, if you were with us just a few minutes ago. Joining me to talk about what is coming now and what might come next in Libya, and oh, what about Syria, another country where the U.S. is calling for its leader to go? Who knows? Will NATO go on to that nation if this war in Libya is actually about to end? Is Gideon Rose, editor of Foreign Affairs magazine and the author of How Wars End, Why We Always Fight the Last Battle. Hey, Gideon, thanks for coming on. This looks like
Great to be here.
Historic week shaping up in Libya, or is this being overhyped?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I was on with you when Mubarak left, and now I'm on when Gaddafi seems to be going.
That's
so
true.
Maybe you should have me on, and we'll see who gets toppled next week.
You're the go-to guy. Keep coming back. We'll talk about Yemen next week, and then we'll talk about Syria. When is the battle over? What are you looking for to signal that they're in charge?
Well, you know, the battle is, you know, long live the battle is over, long live the new battle. The Gaddafi himself needs to essentially exit the scene either by fleeing or being captured or killed. And when that happens, you will have the start of the new era in Libya. The interesting question, of course, that nobody has any answer to right now is what exactly that era will look like. We know it'll be the post-Gaddafi era, but whether the rebels will essentially manage to, A, be able to maintain order, B, not squabble among themselves, and C, set up some kind of durable, sustainable political regime in the aftermath is anybody's guess, and we're all just basically watching, as we have been, frankly, throughout this year, to see what is going to happen next in the Middle East.
Do the rebels have to capture or kill Gaddafi? Is the alternative to that the fear that he'll be able to escape and lead a campaign for reinstatement?
I don't think at this point that he will lead a campaign for reinstatement. His day is over in Libya, and as we saw, once these regimes tend to crumble, the support for the dictator, which was based largely on fear anyway, is usually something that crumbles in a heap. But there will be a sort of psychological sense of closure when he is finally disposed of. And until that happens, people will be basically wondering what's going to happen next. But even as the search for Gaddafi goes on and the final battles go on, the real question is, will the rebels be able to maintain order? Because one of the things we've seen, of course, at this point, it's a commonplace observation, but it's no less true for being that, is that you can get rid of a dictator, but that doesn't necessarily by itself create a new stable political order, a new regime. We've talked of regime change, but that's really a misnomer because it implies that you go from one regime to the next. And as we saw in Iraq most spectacularly, you can get rid of an old regime and get nothing afterwards, and then things in some ways get even worse.
Right. The chaos was starting in Iraq, even simultaneously with the famous moment when the statue of Saddam Hussein was toppled in Firdaus Square, whether that was staged or not. But then what's the next big challenge? Is it finding unity among the Libyan rebel factions?
Well, there's two different challenges. The first challenge is actually literally maintaining order. Who is going to police the streets? Who is going to make sure the public services continue? Who is going to make sure there's some kind of stability in the short term so that chaos doesn't break out? The second question is, once you've established some kind of at least minimal order for the very short term, then what does the ultimate political future of Libya look like? And that's where the divisions in the rebel camp come into play. And by the way, one of the things that's very interesting is the fact that there were risings in Tripoli as part of this last final push is a very good sign, because it means that it wasn't just a rebel attack from the outside. So you don't just have people from outside Tripoli coming in and dominating as the winners. You have some people inside Tripoli who can now say, you know, hey, we were part of this too. It was something of a popular revolution as well. And now we can have a national unity government rather than just have one of the groups or one of the regions dominate the rest.
Gideon Rose, editor of Foreign Affairs magazine, author of How Wars End, Why We Always Fight the Last Battle. And on what appears to be a historic day or the beginning of a historic series of days in Libya, we open the phones. Libyan Americans will get first priority, but anyone may call with your questions if you don't understand what's going on or your comments. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Join the conversation with Gideon Rose or post to our webpage. We have a webpage for every topic we do at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, or you can use our Twitter or Facebook feeds. And Gideon, you know, I'm back today from a two-week vacation, and just before I left, we had a guest on about Libya. This was just after the assassination of General Yunus, military leader of the rebels. And the guest was articulating what was the conventional wisdom of maybe 3 weeks ago, that while Gaddafi would eventually fall, the situation seemed headed for a long-term stalemate. Did all the smart heads get this wrong? Were you saying this 3 weeks ago?
No, because, well, we achieved a much greater, longer stalemate than people had expected originally. The Obama administration's happy talk and the word coming out of Paris and London in April was that this would all be very quick and simple and straightforward. That was proved wrong. This was a lot longer and more involved. NATO did 7,500 sorties as part of this operation. There was a lot of slip there. And now, ultimately, yes, the disparity in power was so great that Gaddafi was always going to lose and did lose. As to when the specific timing, no one can ever predict those things, and it doesn't really, it's never clear when the final act is going to come, and it often comes more quickly than people think. But, that's why it's foolish to bet on the precise timing of these things, because you never know what's going to happen in war. But the more interesting underlying challenges remain even as the day-to-day news events play out at their own pace.
What about President Obama? Maybe this is something. We're not getting a lot of calls. I think people want to just take in what you're saying and hear what's going on. But maybe this is something people are going to want to call about. President Obama, is this a victory for him? Do we say Obama won a war? Remember what was going on in Congress just a few weeks ago, where leaders of the Republican Party and a lot of Democrats, too, were saying, hey, you really have to invoke the War Powers Act because this is a war. Call it whatever you want. You have U.S. warplanes running sorties, doing surveillance, dropping bombs. And so this is a war. But then if the critics are going to say that, to criticize Obama, do they now have to turn around and say, hey, Obama is 1-0 so far in wars concluded?
You know, I don't think that Obama's critics are ever going to give the guy credit for anything. And I think his detractors will look to the length of time that this took compared to what he originally promised and say, you know what, it actually is still a defeat for you, or at least not a major victory. The reality is that Obama was somewhat connected with this, but also held back. And so while I'm sure the administration will defend its conduct and say, look, this proves we were right all along, they're kind of lucky to have gotten this outcome without even more American involvement. And frankly, it's a little too soon to declare victory and go home, because the real question, as I've said, is, okay, now that Gaddafi is gone, what's going to happen in Libya? Now, just as with bin Laden's killing, the American public, frankly, will count this as a victory regardless of what happens next, because they don't really care that much about Libya. And so now that Gaddafi is gone or will be gone soon, people will be able to say Obama got rid of Gaddafi. But for the Libyans, the story is beginning rather than ending. And the Americans really have been a kind of peripheral player. They did help, along with NATO, as a major part of helping the rebels win, but they're not going to be colonizing Libya, and it's going to be a very interesting question now whether the Libyans can maintain any kind of stability themselves. If they can't, then the West will really have to face the somewhat even more difficult question of, do we go in on the ground at all to maintain order if it can't be maintained by the locals?
So Steve Clemens blogged at The Atlantic that an unintended consequence of toppling Saddam in Iraq was the strengthening of Iran in the region. Do you see any similar unintended consequences of toppling Gaddafi?
You know, the fascinating thing about this year is that nobody has been able to call what happens next, and the old calculations are out the window, because there are a variety of different regimes in the Middle East, many of them nasty and authoritarian in one way or another, and they have basically been catching this terrible infection and often sort of either dying or going into crisis. And it happens to American allies, it happens to American enemies, it happens to people who were not particularly connected one way or the other to the United States. And so from the American perspective, okay, gee, Mubarak's loss was the loss of an ally. On the other hand, if Egypt doesn't fall into either chaos or Islamism, then that's actually a pretty good thing. Now, if Syria goes, that would be bad for Iran, good for the United States. Libya, well, we weren't really an ally or an enemy of Gaddafi. Good for the Libyans, and we made ourselves like anti-Gaddafi at the very end there, but instability in Libya wouldn't be a great thing. So basically, until all the dust has settled, we don't know how many of our enemies will be left standing and how many of our friends will be left standing. All we can say is the Middle East, basically, the people of the Middle East are taking their history into their own hands, and it's absolutely thrilling to watch and totally unnerving for policymakers, because you have no idea what's going to happen next.
Gideon Rose, editor of Foreign Affairs magazine, with us as we follow the breaking news from Libya. The fall of Muammar Gaddafi seems imminent. Whether that means minutes or hours or days remains unknown. Gideon Rose, also the author of How Wars End, Why We Always Fight the Last Battle. The latest from the AP, this crossed just a few minutes ago, that U.S. officials were in frequent contact today with Libyan rebels as they claimed control of most of the capital city of Tripoli. However, a top American diplomat said the whereabouts of longtime Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi were still unknown. I was going to go to a caller, but now I think he's not there, or he's talking to my producer. Fred in Yonkers. Hi, Fred. You're on WNYC.
Good morning. Mr. Rose, in 2003, you didn't have this cautious attitude about invading Iraq, did you?
I was, to my everlasting embarrassment, somewhat more pro than con in terms of the attack on Iraq. And one of the reasons why was because I assumed that the Bush administration had more plans than it was telling us. When it became clear that they didn't, that was a giant screw-up on my part, as well as obviously on their part. And so ever since, my attitude towards these things has been a little bit more like Ronald Reagan's line about arms control: trust but verify. And so that's one of the reasons why I was critical of the Libya operation, because nobody in the American side or the European side really had any significant plans for the future of Libya. And now we're going to see, hopefully we'll do a better job than in Iraq, about whether or not it's possible to establish some kind of order in the aftermath of the dictator's fall.
Fred, what do you think about this? I take from your call, Fred, and you can ask your other question, but I'm curious. As someone, I take it, who was against the Iraq war from the outset, what do you think about this?
I think that President Obama went in the wrong way. I think he should have gone to Congress and asked to have permission to go in. I think that people like Mr. Rose are playing up Libya and ignoring Afghanistan, and I don't understand that at all. I think it's very political. I am a firm opponent of realpolitik, because I think it just kicks the can down the road and leads to situations that we have now.
What do you want to see happen in Afghanistan, Fred?
I think we should pull out of Afghanistan. It's as bad or worse than Vietnam in terms of the black holeness of it. We're not going anywhere in Afghanistan. Certainly we're not losing 58,000 troops, but it's a drain on this country.
Fred, thank you for your call.
You know, I think it's interesting there because the irony is that realpolitik is in many respects what would dictate getting out of Afghanistan at this point, because it's clear that it doesn't matter to us that much, and that the people who really would lose out from our leaving Afghanistan by and large would be the good guys and women and civilians in Afghanistan. So, and in the same kind of way, realpolitik for many years meant dealing with the Middle Eastern dictators of one sort or another, whether they were Mubarak or whether they were Gaddafi or whether they are Assad, who basically could provide order and service American interests even as they repress their own people. So you can see, for example, in the Persian Gulf, where the United States is maintaining a policy of realpolitik. We're basically backing the Saudis. We're allowing the Saudis to help suppress revolutions in places like Bahrain. Realpolitik has its merits, as does humanitarianism. The interesting question is, what are the costs, and are you willing to bear the costs of your policies as well as accept the benefits? Mm-hmm. Realpolitik works fine until your dictator collapses, and then you're left with a mess and everybody hates you.
I guess one could argue that it's realpolitik in Afghanistan because the Karzai administration, who we helped install, is so corrupt.
Yeah, and essentially, you know, the question in Afghanistan is, do you want to basically make it better or try to make it better through massive long-term involvement, or walk out and essentially let it fall to its own demons? And there's no easy answer to that one. I'm actually probably more in line with the caller than he might think, certainly on bad days, when it looks like we're not getting that much for our investment there. But I think a long, slow glide out would be better than a quick pullout, because you certainly don't want to see chaos erupting in your wake.
So what happens next after, presumably, Gaddafi falls sometime in the next few hours or next few days? On Thursday, Secretary Clinton called for Syrian President Assad's ouster. Let's move on to Syria and have more regime change. But in this case, she said it would have to come from within.
The transition to democracy in Syria has begun, and it's time for Assad to get out of the way. As President Obama said this morning, no outside power can or should impose on this transition.
So that was Secretary Clinton on Thursday. Arguably, the Assad regime in Syria is actually even much worse than Gaddafi was. But she says this should come from within.
Well, you know, basically no one wants to intervene directly in Syria because it's both a mess there. It's going to be more difficult to maintain order in the aftermath of Assad because of the divisions in the country, because there's a long history. No one's calling for intervention. And basically no one wants to touch Syria, but no one also has any plan for how to make it better. The Assad regime thought it could maintain control and suppress the riots. They were wrong. The Obama administration thought they could get the Assad regime to reform from above and, in effect, co-opt the protests by reforming itself. That's not going to happen because it was based on a fundamental miscalculation about the nature of how oppressive the Assad regime actually was. What you're now seeing through these heroic riots in Syria, the protests, essentially is the crumbling, the slow collapse of yet another Middle Eastern authoritarian dictatorship. But no one really knows what's going to happen next. And the key thing for U.S. diplomacy, I think now they're actually playing this one pretty well in Syria, which is they're trying to get somewhat ahead of history. They're no longer trying to work with Assad, which was always a sort of chump's game, it seems to me. And they're trying to help shape the transition from the Assad regime to a post-Assad regime, it'll probably end up looking, if we can avoid civil war, something a little bit like Iraq today, a kind of messy quasi-democracy with several different parties jockeying for power, not particularly fair or attractive, but better than it was. And if we can actually get there and help bring the surrounding powers to get there without too much violence and foreign intervention, that would be a great coup for us.
And we're out of time, but I guess it's worth mentioning that another difference between Libya and Syria, or Libya and anything, is that Libya was unique that in that the Arab League actually requested NATO military intervention.
Yeah.
And that's not happening anywhere else.
Okay. Nope.
So we thank Gideon Rose, editor of Foreign Affairs Magazine and the author of How Wars End, Why We Always Fight the Last Battle. Thank you again, Gideon.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC coming up next. The New York area has a third of U.S. households with no cars. A third of all the households in the entire country with no cars are here in the New York metro area. But according to this study from the Brookings Institution, and we'll talk to someone from Brookings, according to this study, not all those people with no cars actually live in the city. So we will take calls from those of you who live in the suburbs in our area without a car, as we talk with A.D. Tomer from the Brookings Institution about the study. If you live in the suburbs without a car, call us up, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692.